Would you introduce yourselves, please?
I'm Mick Conroy. I'm in Modern English.
And I'm Robbie, and I'm the singer of Modern English.
You look exactly... Now, wait, I want to ask you both how you pull off looking like you belong in the band.
Good question.
How do you do that?
It's called years of practice.
Yeah, me too. I look like Dennis the Menace.
Yeah.
What are you amazed in... We won't talk about how many... We will talk about how many decades. In all these decades, what are you amazed that no one has asked you, or what do you wish someone actually would ask you?
You know, why we make music.
I have a question for you.
Yeah, go on then.
Why do you write music?
Because we're creative people.
Because we've got a pile of instruments and and we've now got our own recording studio.
So 40 years since the release of After the Snow, the band began as teenagers.
We all did know each other from the same town. We all grew up in the same town. Teenagers in the pubs, at the football matches.
Where it really did start was in Camden, the Good Mixer. Did you manage to go in there?
I didn't, no.
That is the pub.
Is that the pub?
That is the pub where Britpop started.
Wow.
Without a shadow of a doubt. It had a pool table and the carpet was basically... But if the toilets were full, the carpet was as sticky as the toilets. Yeah. So the Good Mixer.
And I'm willing to bet you have not played all the songs live. Am I correct?
Yeah.
So you had to actually learn your own record.
Yeah. We couldn't play Carry Me Down for about 30 years. Which is one of the tracks on the After the Snow album.
Right.
We're playing it tonight, and we're playing it on this tour, and the actual album in the whole order for the first time ever.
So what does it feel like to have to actually do your own material and realize you don't know your own damn material?
Well, there's you don't know the half of it either. There's another track called Face of Wood that I'm convinced we'd never even played live either. So there's two tracks on the album that... We just recorded and left it at that.
I was a young lad in 1982, and it was this brand new thing called Home Box Office, and this movie comes on, right? And I lived in New York at the time, and this movie comes on, and you know where I'm going, and it's called Valley Girl. And I watch this thing, and then I buy a VHS, and then, and this is a true story, back then, there were the soundtrack of that movie, you probably know that they couldn't get the proper licensing. They put out this like little mini soundtrack of like six songs. It wasn't until Rhino, a million years later, got all the licensing. I came to you that way. You had the place in the movie that made me feel hopeful that some maniac from Hollywood could find the Valley Girl. Getting a sink like that, they didn't have a lot of money. This was not a big budget film by any stretch. Do you have any idea like what the sink money was for that thing?
I don't think it was very much at all.
Over 12 pounds?
Probably.
£12.50.
I think they said, you know, come back and we'll give you a tenner. But
right.
I mean, in those days, it was kind of, I mean, it was unheard of to be in a band like us. Or any band, and to be in a film. You know, it didn't really happen.
But that soundtrack...
We were on a tour bus, and they pulled us over on the side of the road and said, put a VHS, woo-hoo, in the machine, and said, watch this, and showed us Valley Girl, and we didn't know anything about it. That's the first we knew about it.
Wow.
And then we were like, wow, it's in the film three times. It's
no
on
kidding.
The credits, it's on in the kind of love thing in the middle when they're all running around on the beach and stuff.
Yeah, it's like you and my good friend Peter Case, the Plimsolls, you are the movie.
Yeah, that was a good break for us. And you'd be amazed, like your story, how many people come to us the same way.
You're not one-hit wonders, and yet that does get applied. You have had other songs that have, you know, made you a few more pounds and that people know. So when you're you and the first thing someone does, and this is not the, are you sick of performing? I know that answer. You'll perform until the day you die because why not? Maybe you'll do a reggae version someday.
We've done one.
I bet you have.
In Birmingham, Alabama.
There you go. In Alabama, y'all.
Yeah.
Great. How do you explain to people that this is not a one-hit wonder band? And do you care?
I don't really care when people think that, but I mean, we've done 6-7 albums. Road Time Out With You, and it was included on the album After the Snow. It was just another song on the record. We had no idea that it was going to be, you know.
So you didn't turn to yourself and say, this is a bitch in middle eight and these are hooks?
No.
We actually thought it was too commercial.
Well, it was.
Yeah. We kind of looked at it, you know, and thought, we've never really written a song like this before. This is wild, you know, do we like it or not? Went through a kind of crisis, and then we got used to it and really liked it after that.
I said to Hugh Jones, the producer who made it, that, you know, we're unsure, it's too poppy, and he just said, you're out of your mind. And then he said, don't be afraid of pop.
Well, what he said was, Robbie, don't shout into the microphone. Talk into the microphone. He didn't mention chocolate. And so, and the first track I did it on was I Melt With You as well, which I think is why it's got that kind of
the cadence
speaking sort of verse in it, because it's the first time I'd had to try and do that. I didn't know how to do it.
But you were so far ahead of the trends, because think of all the things that are out today 40 years later that do that, and everybody says, wow, how about that? They're kind of, I'm thinking like this, all these bands, Dry Cleaning, there's a million of them out there now that are all, you know, kind of like, oh, we're doing something new.
Yeah, but
not really.
Well, God bless them. They're doing what they want to do, I suppose. Yeah. I mean, everyone looks back to look forward, don't they?
There's
not much left to do with music, really.
What do you think he got into your head that kind of took you to the next place?
Good question. I think, I mean, even though before we'd met Hugh, we'd done songs on the first album, Mechelet's first chorus, middle eight, outro, chorus.
Right.
Swan Song Last, same deal. So, you know, I knew, you know, and I've listened to enough records in my time to know that's a verse, that's a chorus, that's a bridge.
Yes.
And with Hugh, though, we had loads of songs that we didn't have a proper structure for. And what he introduced to us was the idea of that part from that song over there might work in this song here. That, you know, what you've written is not sacred until it's recorded. And at the end of the session, you've got all of, you know, when it's basically, he believed that the, like you were saying about the pop songs, he believed that the song from the beginning to the end is the important thing. It's basically how to get from the beginning to the end and to actually make a statement and get your point across.
You had a lot of cachet because you were a 4AD band. When you were signed to 4AD, were you aware you were back then kind of joining rock and roll royalty, or was it just you got a good see, you know where I'm going here? Or was it, ooh, we got signed, we got a deal? Cool.
No, I mean, we sent a small little demo tape out to a lot of different record companies, including Rough Trade. And we didn't get anything back except for, it was Beggar's Banquet before 4AD.
Right, indeed.
And they showed interest. And then they invited us to London to play a concert. And then we got signed, first concert we were playing with Bauhaus. And both bands got signed the next day.
Okay. At what point did you decide, now, the original band name was L-A-P-E-R-S?
Lepers, the Lepers.
That's right. Yeah. At what point did you decide that there was a better name than the Lepers?
When we started being able to play more music than punk rock, because the Lepers was a punk band and none of us could really play.
But I really would have loved saying, and that was the Lepers with I Melt With You.
We recorded our first demos, and when we went into the studio, we were called the Lepers. And the songs that we'd never recorded in the studio before. And when we were in the studio, we were thinking it's impossible for us to send these demos to a record company with the Lepers written on it. And that was the thing that Ivo and Peter Kent at 4AD, they used to work in the record shop downstairs at Beggar's Banquet, and they used to play demos that would get sent to Beggar's Banquet. And they kept, you know, they heard that demo in the tape machine. And if it had said the Lepers, they wouldn't have put it. Peter Kent might have played it.
It's a pleasure when people say it. They're like, well, you are the John Peel, you know, of the U.S. And I go, I say, well, thank you so much. But doing a session, that must have been the second. Did that feel like, I mean, because that's a pivotal moment.
I've got a great story.
Like you and I here, of course.
Oh, this is rock and roll history.
Yeah.
No, but I've got a great story about that. I took our demo tape and first single, which was our own release called Drowning Man on Limp Records, and I took that down to Maida Vale, to the BBC. Actually, it was in Oxford Street, Great Portland Street, and he came in and I gave it to him, and my phone number was on there. I was a local lad, and next week I was at a nightclub, And the phone rang in the nightclub, and the bouncer, or the, as you call him, the doorman here, he came over and said, there's a phone call for you. And I phoned, picked the phone up, it's my mum, my mother, back home, and she said, John Peel's just phoned you up.
Oh, my gosh.
And that's, it went from there with him. He looked after us. He looked after a lot of the local bands.
New record. You mentioned somewhere that it might be noisy again. Ooh, tell me. Tell me what you can tell me.
Well, we suddenly had a 2-year break, and me and Rob and Gary and Steve got into my studio after sending files back and forward to each other, and on this bunch of songs we got, it's a lot more powerful and energetic. And then when Gary came into the studio for the demos, that's kind of the whole thing opened up. I said to him, you know, play how you played 20 years ago, 30 years ago. A bit like the first Banshees LP.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm.
And also the sound that Mick Ronson used on Ziggy Stardust.
Which has just hit its anniversary. Yeah,
yeah, that's right, 50.
Yeah.
And so, you know, Gary was like, yeah, I can do that. No problem. And
so when does this thing magically come into our midst?
Well, magically when it's finished, we're thinking about bringing in a producer. We don't know who, why, or when, but we might bring someone in to act like Hugh did with us, really. You know, become a sixth member of the band.
Nice.
We've written like about 10 things, pieces of music and lyrics and bits of music and whole songs. We've got a lot of stuff. It's all varied, but we need someone to tie it all together, maybe, unless we just go down the mesh and lace approach, which is, we can do it, we know how to do that, just do it.
I've invented a thing called a musical sandwich, and what it is two of your songs on the outside, and then songs by others in between, and then I go into the studio old school. This is going to be 40 minutes of solid music. Mm.